Welcome to the Charlotte Readers Podcast, where books and writing topics are center stage and where authors give voice to the written words. I'm Landis Wade, and on behalf of my co-host, Hannah LaRue and Sarah Archer, we thank you for listening.
The Charlotte Readers Podcast is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey listeners, this is Sarah Archer. Before we get started with today's show, I have a quick word. Charlotte Readers Podcast now has podcast books. It's true, we have two kinds, fiction and nonfiction. Our fiction book is titled Death by Podcasting, co-written by Landis and me. It's a comedic mystery where we make fun of podcasters and writers in the vein of Only Murders in the Building. It was a lot of fun to write, and it's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. We also have 8 nonfiction quote books created from over 500 podcast interviews. The Write Quote series is a collection of inspirational and practical quotes about writing, publishing, and book marketing from the first 4 years of the podcast. The books come with forewords and reflections by Hannah, Landis, and me. They're available in paperback and ebook, and here's a bonus. The first ebook in the series, about the writing life, can be downloaded for free. You can find links for all 9 books at the podcast books page of charlottereaderspodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and if you read our books, thanks for reading. Now let's get on with the show.
Hey listeners, we are here today with a super fun episode. I'm Hannah LaRue, your host for this episode, and we are talking with Catherine Faulkner, and she is an award-winning journalist who studied history at Cambridge. She has worked as an investigative reporter and an editor and was formerly the joint head of the news at the Times in London. She lives in London now, where she also grew up with her husband and 2 daughters. She's the author of The Other Mothers and Greenwich Park. I always like butcher that name every time I would say that growing up. And we're talking about The Other Mothers today, which I'm so excited to talk with you about, Catherine. Thank you for taking the time for this evening for you. It's like 8 o'clock for you, isn't it?
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I have so many questions for you. First, though, I want to kind of dive into your background. So I know you grew up in London. You kind of always have stayed in that area.
That's right. I've lived in other places in the UK and obviously have traveled. Mm-hmm. I've come back to live where I grew up, which is in North London. And yeah, I find London endlessly inspiring as a place. It's so interesting and layered. And there are so many different, it's a bit like New York in the sense that there's lots of different villages with their own kind mm-hmm. of personality and their own character. But it's also unlike anywhere else in the sense that it's got such a sense of, there's obviously all the history and you have this sense of the old fighting with the new, and there's quite a lot of, I think London society, there's quite a lot of hang-ups from the past, you know, there's the kind of mm-hmm. around class and money, and it's a city that is just obsessed with property and, it's just it makes for a very interesting social dynamic. There's a big divide between the people who have the property and the people who don't. It's just, but everyone lives up against each other, kind of the people who have and the people who don't have. They're all kind of squished together in this incredibly densely populated, huge city. I find it fascinating and an endless source of inspiration.
Yeah, it's you know, we'll kind of dive into a lot of what you just said, because some of these themes you can definitely, you know, detect in The Other Mothers, just with like the division of class and these different people that live in the same place. But, you know, I noticed, so you studied history at Cambridge, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Do you think it was kind of like you're like growing up in London in such a historical place is sort of how you decided to get into that?
I don't know if it was that so much as the fact that I always loved stories, you know, stories have always mm-hmm. been my thing. And so really for me, you know, I knew from a really young age that I wanted to, that I was interested in words and stories. And all I wanted to do when I was younger was write stories. And make them into books when I was, you know, in primary school. But I think you get a bit older and then you sort of stop being encouraged to write creatively, which I think is really sad. But, you know, it's all about the academics once you get to secondary school. And so mm-hmm. I think for me, the choice was between history and English, the sort of 2 things I loved. And I loved English and I loved literature, but I was also really interested in stories from the past, and I think I had a really good history teacher, to be honest with you, who brought the subject to life. And I just loved history, and I was also really interested in politics, and had the kind of idea by the time I left school, I kind of had the idea by the time I was going to university that I might want to pursue a career in journalism, which is what I have done for most of my career before I became an author full time only last year. So most of my career I've been a journalist. So I felt like the history was kind of a good grounding for that, and it has been. I loved my degree, and Cambridge was a wonderful place to spend 3 years studying. It's so, so beautiful there, and everything about it was wonderful. And yeah, and then after that I trained as a journalist, as a newspaper journalist, and spent, you know, over a decade working in newspapers. So I worked sometimes in London, but also in Birmingham and Manchester, other cities around the UK, and did some travel abroad as well, and some undercover work. So I did lots of different things within
journalism. Ooh, I want to hear about that. So
everyone always
tell me about. No, you probably can't. That's amazing. And first of all, congratulations on transitioning into being a full-time author. I know that's like a dream for so many people.
I know. I mean, it was a really strange, I still find it quite strange that that's my full-time job. It's very different. You know, and there's a lot of things about being a journalist that I really miss, like the working as part of a team and the adrenaline of a newsroom and the energy and the constant human contact and being at the centre of everything. I mean, it couldn't be more different to sitting in a library just making up stories about people you've dreamed up in your head. I mean, it's just a very strange existence that I lead now. I don't really know what to tell you about that. To be honest, I'm finding it really strange. I obviously love writing books. I mean, I have to pinch myself that this is what I get to do as my job. I love it. And my favorite thing about it is that, you know, was when people read the book and just love it and write to tell me that on social media, or, you know, they email me, or I get the messages from all over the world at like all times of the day and night, people from Brazil or, you know, parts of America that I maybe haven't even heard of. And they are like telling me, oh my God, I was just reading this the whole night. I couldn't put it down. And it is so gratifying and so touching and incredible. And so all of that is just amazing. But the actual day-to-day job, if you've been a national newspaper journalist for 10 years, it's quite weird.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I can imagine, though, probably, well, maybe a way for you to kind of incorporate that into your writing is that I'm sure you've gotten tons of inspiration from your years as a journalist.
Oh, absolutely. Do you feel like...
Okay, so you revisit some of the stories and, you know, experiences that you had as an investigative reporter. Do you kind of think about that often as you're writing?
Definitely. And in fact, it was a court case that I covered as a reporter many years ago, which inspired the other mothers. So
okay,
the story of Sophie and her being found in the reservoir, and the idea of this kind of, could it be an accident? Could it be a murder? The ambiguity around that actually came from a court case that I really covered as a trainee reporter many years ago, and it's always stuck in my mind. It was an inquest into a death that seemed to me to be very suspicious, but which was kind of written off as a kind of, we don't know, as an open verdict, because there basically wasn't enough evidence of what had happened to this young man. And I couldn't get over that. I just thought, if that was their family, how unsatisfying that, like, there was no real evidence that he had been, that it had been an innocent death, and it was no evidence that it was a suspicious death. They just kind of said, we don't know, so sorry.
Yeah.
And I talked to lots of, when I was researching this novel, I talked to lots of coroners and pathologists and people involved in the inquest process, and they said, yeah, absolutely, a murder could be missed in this way, because sometimes there's just not, things look dodgy, but there's just not enough, that's not enough for a court of law. You know, that's not enough for a murder conviction. You need motive, you need the person, you need proper DNA evidence. You know, juries see DNA on TV and they expect DNA. You know, if you don't have DNA, they're not going to convict anybody these days. And it was just so interesting to hear, you know, this is what could... So what fascinated me about all that was the disconnect between the truth, the real truth, yeah, and the truth as per what comes out of a judicial process. And as a journalist, you're up against that all the time. You know, if you're covering a big court case, there's basically two versions of the truth, and the jury have to just pick. And then whichever the jury pick, that's the truth. And that becomes the record, to the point where if you're covering a really big court case and it's going to be the front page and you're waiting for a jury verdict, you usually have a guilty front page and a not guilty front page. And you just kind of click go on the right one when the verdict comes back, you know, because that's how it is now. And so the story could have been very different if the jury made a different decision on the day. So it's that disconnect between the real truth and what we all learn to be the truth and what a journalist is allowed to report as the truth, I found really, really interesting, and have always found interesting. And also just the people at the centre of that truth who were there and who know what really happened and what happens to them after that official process has finished and they're left behind, like Sophie's mother, Jane, in the book. You know, she's just left with nothing. She's not had her satisfaction from the kind of bureaucratic processes. They've delivered her no closure. And she wants to find out what really happened to her daughter. And it's incredibly hard. So Tash is but what's interesting about Tash, the journalist who's looking into this case, is that she's trying to do a number of things. She's trying to do right by Jane and help this bereaved mother because she genuinely feels for her. But also she wants her scoop that's going to relaunch her career after her.
Right.
She had to give up her job full time to look after her son, which is what so many journalists have to do. In all over the world, because the job is very, very demanding. And if you're a mother of young children, it can be really, really difficult to reconcile your work if you're a staff newspaper reporter with your job. So a lot of very good journalists end up going freelance, and then they have this kind of really difficult, and it's really difficult to make that work. So she's in that struggling place, and she really wants to get a good scoop to kind of get herself back on the map. But also she becomes very intrigued by this story when she realizes how close it is to home and to the other mothers, the glamorous other mothers that she sees all the time at her son's playgroup, who she was kind of already obsessed with. But then when she realizes that they and this case are entangled, it takes on a whole new dimension for her and becomes very, very complicated.
Right. Oh my gosh. And that was a great kind of overview for our listeners too, just sort of what they can expect with this book. I mean, it's really an interesting story for a lot of reasons, but you know, it kind of dives into a lot of topics that I think a lot of different groups can kind of relate to. So, you know, like you said, we have Tash, who's the main character here, and she has her son, who is he two or three? He's really young and she's started going to this playgroup with, and I love how you kind of even call them throughout the book, the other mothers, because it's like the other mothers. It's a group of women who are there with their kids as well. And her son initially didn't really want to go in there. And then finally he kind of makes friends with one of the other mother's children, and they sort of all start hanging out together. And it's pretty clear that they have more money than Tash does, which is kind of my dog is cheering in the back for this story. She's like, I loved reading this also. But yeah, there's kind of a division there, right? So it's sort of
Absolutely.
Tash trying to be included with them, but still, you know, struggling on the outside with how exactly to do that. And also trying to kind of solve this mystery of what happened to Sophie. So let's talk about Sophie's character a little bit. Can you just talk about how you said it was inspired by, you know, something that you were already kind of looking into you'd looked into in the past for your journalism job, but how did you kind of flesh out her character and where you wanted her to go?
Well, I was really interested in the age difference between Sophie and the other characters. And I think there is a generational divide between, so Tash and the other mothers, they're kind of my age, I guess. They're in their 30s raising young children. And Sophie is 21. So she's much younger, and she is from a different generation with different expectations and different values, really. And that's become a kind of running theme in the media, you know, this kind of big these generational divides. And I think that they're interesting. So that adds another kind of layer of tension. Also, she's the nanny, right? And they are the employers, the employer class, I guess, of mothers who live in big houses and who are middle class enough to afford nannies. Tash can't afford a nanny, but that's the position that these other mothers are in. I was just so interested in the dynamic between nanny and employer, and how, because a nanny is, you entrust them with so much. You're entrusting them with your children's upbringing, essentially, their safety, their well-being for many, many hours of the day. And you're also having this person in your home, which is really intense, right? To share your home with somebody. And so they're kind of part of your family, really, but also they're not. And that dynamic I found psychologically fascinating. I also think it's quite psychologically difficult for any mother, especially a first-time mother like Tash is. I mean, I don't really care about it now. I'm just like waving mine off to daycare, like, goodbye. See you later. But I think the first time you're kind of like, oh my God, is this person going to replace me? You know, are they going to encroach on my, you know, on my status in my children's mind? Are they going to be better at it than me? And the thing is, Sophie is really, really good at what she does. And she has this amazing bond with the children she looks after. I don't want to reveal too much about who those children are, because obviously that's part of the mystery. But she is, and that is a relationship that becomes very fraught and very difficult. And so I was fascinated by that. And there's also a class difference there and a money difference there. So all of these things kind of ratchet up the tension between Sophie and her employer. And I found that very fun to write.
Oh, that's
it was
amazing.
Quite hard to write her though, because she was young and cool. So I had to kind of like rein in I had to really think about my language and think, okay, young people don't talk like that. Scrub that bit out.
Young and cool, live vicariously through her in some ways.
I mean, she's not that cool, but she's, you know, she's young.
Pretty cool.
So she's cooler than all the other characters by definition.
Yeah, and I love how you know, part of the book is told from Sophie's perspective too. So we have Tash and Sophie. We're kind of going back and forth for most of the book between the two of them. Why did you decide to do that?
I just thought it would be fun for the reader to kind of have Tash uncovering this story bit by bit, and then the reader getting to actually glimpse the truth. And it was all about that disconnect that I talked about between the real truth and the truth which can be uncovered later, or that the facts and the evidence would present as this is what happened. And how those two things can be really different things. That's the kind of point, I guess, I'm making with the dual timelines, is that everybody has their own truth. And Tash is a very good reporter, and she's able to piece together a narrative which comes close, but it never really touches the real truth, which you can only get from Sophie. And so you hear a bit by bit, sometimes, you know, you'll get, Tash will uncover something interesting, but then Sophie's chapter will throw a very different light on that. So, I mean, it was important to me to do that, and I thought it would be fun to read, but honestly, it was quite hard work. My editor did say, you know, you're attempting something that's structurally quite difficult here. I was like, am I?
You did a great job.
Well, it took a while to get it right, but I am proud of how it turns out, and I do think it works for the reader. And I think I just didn't realize that it would. I think it took me a while to make it one story, you know. I was kind of writing these two stories, and then it was connecting them and having them kind of talk to each other, the two timelines.
It's funny you say talk to each other. Because I think that they kind of, even though they never meet, obviously, because Sophie is the person who is no longer with us, and that's kind of part of the premise, but so they never meet each other, right? But it almost feels like they have a relationship with each other, just because of how the story works out. Like, we do see both perspectives. were kind of along this journey, and they are connected. And that kind of, you know, it's interesting too, because I feel like a big part of this story is the relationships in general. Tasha's relationship with her son, with her husband, with the children of the other mothers in the group, with the other mothers. How did you kind of flesh out all of the relationships in this book? Did you storyboard, or how did you keep them all sort of organized?
Oh no, I don't do anything sensible as that. No, I just make it up as I go along. I mean, with Tash, the first part of what you were saying, yes, like Tash and Sophie, their relationship is very interesting. Obviously, they have no relationship. Mm-hmm. They never meet. And Sophie never knows Tash, but they do have certain shared experiences. So they both lost their father at a young age, and they both feel like outsiders compared to this kind of cast of glamorous women. So I think from that point of view, Tash sees something in Sophie that's, they're not exactly similar, but she has a certain sympathy with her, and she knows what it's like to feel on the outside of these people's lives. And she's also, they're both the kind of person who likes to stand up for what's right, and that gets them in trouble. They're not people neither of them are the kind of personality to like let something drop.
Yeah.
So I think that, yes, the parallels were important and did make an interesting dynamic, and I think all of that gives Tash a certain impetus to, she wants to know what happened to this girl.
Yeah.
And she wants to be able to tell that story. The relationships in the book. Yeah, I mean, I just find relationships between women totally fascinating, and the dynamics of them and the wrinkles in between these friendships that we make as mothers, particularly, and how interacting with children around is a different experience, and a different experience of friendship. I think, you know, when you become a mother, your friendships change and dynamics shift in really interesting ways between you and other women. Whether it's the women that you always knew from your life who were like who have been your friends forever, and sometimes those friendships completely endure and they grow with your newfound motherhood status, and sometimes the dynamics of those friendships become difficult when you become a mother for all sorts of different reasons. And then I think motherhood creates a certain loneliness and vulnerability in us, that where we do seek out people who are going through the exact same thing at the same time, we need those other mum friends who understand, you know, what it's like, and they were up all night too, and they might have the answer to your problem that you're trying to resolve. And there is a certain, not desperation, but there is a certain, you're looking for these friends, and you make friends quite quickly in those scenarios. And that's kind of what Greenwich Park was about as well. It's like this kind of, you know, this lonely, anxious, neurotic pregnant mother who's desperate to make just one friend at her antenatal class, and then ends up bitterly regretting that decision. But, you know, similarly, Tash, you know, she really wants new friends to help her navigate motherhood. And she's also, at the same time, quite seduced by the wealth of these women and the lifestyle they lead, and they make motherhood look so easy, because guess what, they've got loads of money, so they have nannies and they have beautiful houses where the kids can run around, and they have, you know, expensive food on home delivery, and they just, you know, they don't need to worry about, you know, sitting there pureeing carrots themselves because they've got someone to do that for them. So all of that stuff is they're almost like the living embodiment of the Instagram version of motherhood.
Yeah.
Which we all want, and is of course a total fantasy unless you're a millionaire. But Tash finds it very seductive, and she's the sort of person who is on, you know, she's on Instagram, she's looking at other people and wondering why she doesn't have that life. You know, her and her husband work really hard, but they can only afford this, you know, pokey basement flat. They don't have a lot of spare money, even the childcare costs are a lot, and she's trying to justify the childcare costs by trying to earn a living. And but then when she's not earning, it, you know, then they're paying for this childcare, but she's not earning, so how is she justifying her life? You know, all of that kind of stuff she's worrying about, and that's her reality. But being friends with these women allows her to escape that reality for a bit and just think about, oh, let's just sit and have this really, really expensive coffee in this really nice cafe. And she just craves that. Yeah. That's what she wants. And it's sort of what she expected. And the interesting thing about London is that you have women who are friends, mm-hmm. who all have very different, they might have the same sort of level of education and level of kind of professional attainment, but depending on the industry they're working in, they've got very different incomes and very different lifestyles as a result. You know, you can be a really, really high achieving person in teaching mm-hmm. or publishing, but you're not making the money that a really high achieving person in finance is making. It won't even be comparable. It'll be multiples. They'll be earning multiples, multiples, multiples of what you are. So you can have, but you would be, the friendship between you would be very natural in the same way that it's natural for Tash to, you know, she can hold her place intellectually with these women more than that, but she's just not, she can't keep up with them financially.
Yeah.
Although she tries to. And so all of that is quite interesting as well as a dynamic, I think.
Yeah, totally. It's a super interesting thing to think about. I mean, you know, and again, I think it's insane and amazing how you're able to weave in these themes that a lot of people can relate to. Well, it sounds like especially in London, probably a lot of different big cities.
I'm sure it's very similar. It's just that's my little world.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I'm writing about.
For sure.
But yeah, I'm sure it's absolutely the same in big cities all over the world. And lots of these things are universal. Motherhood mm-hmm. is a universal experience,
right.
as much as it feels very specific to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually also this wonderful bridge between us and other women. And I think that that's something that's been really nice about my books, is that they do connect with, particularly with women who've been through that.
Hey listeners, this is Sarah Archer with a brief request. If you enjoy our podcast, please leave us a short online review wherever you like to listen. Better yet, please tell your friends. If you do both, you get extra credit. Seriously though, listeners learn about new podcasts by reviews and words of mouth. So when you help us spread the word about Charlotte Readers Podcast, more people meet our author guests and more readers and writers share our love of reading and writing. Thanks for listening. Now back to the show.
So do you have a reading that you could share with us today?
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome.
I will read you from one of, so this is from one of Tash's chapters.
Perfect.
So it's written from the point of view of Tash. And she has just had Sophie Blake. So she's interested in the death of Sophie Blake, who is a young nanny who was found dead in a beauty spot near where Tash lives. And the mother of Sophie Blake has just turned up unexpectedly at her house. Jane Blake stands awkwardly by the fridge and watches me lift him down, wipe his face, tell him off. Finn whines a little as I carry him into the next room and place him on the sofa. When I reach for the remote control, the whining stops. You can watch one Bing. I wag the remote control at him like a finger. Only one, okay? Finn's face breaks into a smile, his pale hair falling over his eyes, soft and fine as cotton candy. I reach out to push the silken strands behind his ears. In the kitchen, Jane is still standing by the fridge. Have a seat. I motion to a chair, but she ignores me, fixes me with a cold stare. You don't remember me. The moment she says it, though, I do. You were at the reservoir, I murmur, the other day. That's right, she lifts her chin. I've seen you there before, looking for the place where my daughter died. I want to talk to you about all this rubbish you wrote. She tosses the article onto my kitchen table. For a moment, neither of us moves. Why don't you have a seat? I ask gently. Jane eventually sits gingerly down on one of the kitchen chairs, ending up with her knees pushed up against a table leg. Our kitchen is so narrow that we could only assemble one half moon of the circular dining table we bought from IKEA when we moved in. The other half is folded down permanently next to the wall. I rummage in the cupboard for my notebook, a working pen, and then sit down opposite Jane. She is unfolding the crumpled printout on the table, flattening it with her hands. Jane, legally, I had to report what the coroner found, which was that Sophie's death was most likely an accident. That she had... I know what the coroner said, Jane spits. It didn't happen. So what do you think happened? My daughter was murdered, Natasha. Someone killed her. They killed her and they put her into that water. As I open my mouth to reply, Finn reappears. Mummy, Bing not working. He starts fussing at my knees. There is a ghostly outline of milk around his mouth. I pluck a wet wipe from the packet on the table and bat at him with it. I'm really sorry, I tell Jane, as Finn twists away in protest. Once the TV is reanimated, I return to the kitchen. Jane shifts in her chair. Her eyes drift down to my leggings, where a glob of Finn's porridge has been deposited on my right thigh. I called your office. Jane is still looking at the blob of porridge. They said you don't work there no more. Yes, I say. I left quite soon after the inquest. I start wiping the porridge off my leggings. I don't elaborate. I really don't feel like getting into the whole miserable story. So you don't actually have a job then? No, I mean, yes, I do, but I'm freelance now. Oh, the corners of Jane's mouth have turned down. It's a good thing, I add, a bit too quickly and with a touch too much brightness. It means I can place stories anywhere. Jane can see that there is a degree of spin at work here, but she stays silent. She plucks a photograph from her handbag, sets it on the table. A peace offering of sorts, perhaps. I haven't seen this picture of Sophie before. She looks younger than 21, an elfin face, a smattering of summer freckles across her nose and cheeks. She was a lovely girl, I say. She was. She was. And now she is dead. There is a shameful part of me that wants to recoil from Jane, just because of the terrible truth that she is proof of. This could happen to me. My child could die. Maybe that explains my feeling when I saw her on the front step, the tightening of my hand on the lock. You can smell it on a person, that sort of damage. I look up at Jane, place my pen down for a moment. Finn calls out in the other room, and I ignore it. Do you have any idea who would have done such a thing, Jane? Jane glowers at me. I wouldn't be here if I knew that, would I? She leans back in her chair. Anyway, that's your bit, isn't it? I'm sorry, I say, I don't follow. Jane's eyes narrow. I thought you said you were still a journalist. I am, but... Well then, she says, tapping a finger on the table. You need to investigate. You need to find out who killed my daughter.
Oh my gosh, yeah. You know what I just realized as you were reading that? It's not only is it kind of like... you know, getting the reader's gears turning about the actual mystery behind what happened to Sophie, but you're sort of realizing how much Tash multitasks, like, you know, how to organize.
How much we all do.
Yeah, right? How much we all do. Yeah, exactly. And as a mother, you're right. It's like you see yourself in a lot of these scenes in this book. I mean, hopefully we're not going to come across, or I guess you did in your previous work, a similar situation, but you know, it's like trying to kind of manage so many things at one time and your emotions, because it is true. And it kind of reminds me as well, just like as a parent watching the news today, even can be really scary, you know, just sort of that could be my child. Can you tell me a little bit about the research process for this? I know you mentioned you kind of talked to some croners, just different people in the field. How did you kind of go about doing all of that?
Yeah, so I talked to coroners, pathologists. I'm just very ballsy about contacting people because I'm a journalist, so I don't mind ringing people up and just saying, hey, will you talk to me? And the funny thing is that when you're writing a book, like a crime book, people are always really interested in that. They're like, oh, are you? Like, that's really weird. Okay, I don't mind talking to you. Especially if they know it's not going to be, you know, it's not actually going to be.
Yeah.
You're not quoting them for an article. People get really like, oh God, I might say the wrong thing. But when you just say, no, I'm just making up a made up story about a woman who got found in some wetlands.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I'll tell you how that might go down. So that was all really interesting. I have, luckily when I was at university, I had a lot of friends who studied medicine, who I'm still in touch with, and they were super helpful on the medical side of, so there's two doctor characters in The Other Mothers. One of whom is Tash's husband. So kind of the logistics around that and what it means to be a medic in an A&E department. Mm-hmm. All of that, I kind of needed some reality injecting there. So they were super helpful with that. And I spoke to nannies as well a bit. Wow. About what it's like being a nanny, being a live-in nanny. I know a lot of nannies anyway, because I'm just in that world, I guess. That was interesting to talk to them about it, and different experiences of like nice families and not so nice families, and what the differences are. I mean, how they manage that boundary. Uh-huh. You know, that was really interesting. So I did quite a lot of research for this project. Really, I even spoke to a guy who works in the reservoirs. I spoke to a few people who work around the, because the Woodbury Wetlands is a real place, And they made it, that it was two old horrible reservoirs in the middle of London that got made into this amazing nature reserve with this big new development next to it. And so the guy who was at the London Wildlife Trust, who was responsible for transforming these reservoirs into a wetlands area, he was really excited. Oh, that I was writing a book about a body turning up in one of his reservoirs.
Okay.
I thought he might be horrified, but he was like, this is the best thing ever. And then he put me in touch with the guy who knows all about the logistics of how the reservoir works. Uh-huh. and all of that. And he was really interesting. I kind of ended up making him into the character of the guy who works at the wetlands. He's got the two dogs and he finds the phone.
Did you tell him that?
Well, he knows now.
Amazing.
I didn't even save his name on my phone. I just saved him as like Chris, and then I texted him later. I was like, can I have your full name so I can put you in my acknowledgements? And he was just like, ghosted me. So I'm like, thank you to Chris.
He might be a character for real, a big one in the next book. You never know, maybe he's got some stories.
Yeah, he deserves his own series.
That's amazing. That was his moment. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, I have one more question. I feel like I could talk with you forever. But I wanted to see, especially now that you're a full-time writer, so this is what you do all the time now, which is just amazing. What is something that you would have told yourself before you wrote your first book about the writing life, or what you've learned about yourself as an
author? That's a tough one. That's a really good question. It's a really good question. I wish I could think of loads of sage advice I could now draw upon. What would I say? Do you know, one thing I would say is that to trust your process, because my process is not anything that sounds good when I describe it. It's not linear at all. It's whatever the opposite of linear is. And it involves quite a lot of thinking around things and quite a lot of words that go in the bin. And I've just I think now I'm on my third book, I've kind of learned that that's okay and that I need to do it that way. And that's just how it makes sense to me. And when I was writing The Other Mothers, one thing I got very hung up on was everyone else's advice on how to write a book. You know, I wanted to do it more efficiently and I wanted to do it correctly. And for example, people say, don't go back and edit, you know, just keep going, just plow through, get yourself a first draft, and then you can, which is great advice if you can do that. But sometimes you do have to go back and change it because the idea's changed. And otherwise you end up with something that just doesn't make any sense as a first draft, which is what I did with The Other Mothers. So that was, you know, that was pointless for me, you know. And so I think sometimes you just have to trust your instincts. You only have your way of writing books. And so you just have to go with it. And I think the other thing is to keep hold of the joy in writing, which is a kind of related thing. Because actually, for me, if I was to have a spreadsheet and plot my whole book and chapter by chapter plan out every single thing I was going to write, it would take the joy from it for me. And so, yeah, it would be probably way more efficient and a better way of writing a book if you can do it like that. But for me, the joy is the experience of discovery when you're writing scenes and you don't actually quite know where you're going with it, but you're learning about your characters through the writing, and it's a genuinely creative, imaginative process. And so that's to me the whole point. So I wasn't going to move away from that in the interests of efficiency. And I've kind of made my peace with that now, and that's fine.
Yeah, that's so great. I think that's such I think something that is really hard for writers is that you do kind of get told, oh, this is how you get from A to B. This is how you get published, or this is how you...
But also you stress and you're very hard on yourself, and you read things back and you tell yourself you're terrible and it's all pointless and you're writing something that is mm-hmm. worthless. And actually, I think sometimes it's really useful to just remind yourself why you're doing it. And to try and protect that joyfulness and not have it diluted too much by what everybody else is telling you to do or
imposter syndrome.
Just try and carve out and just carve out that time where it's just you and your manuscript. Mm-hmm. Nobody else is involved, and it's and nobody else has to see it, and you can just go for it. That's the most precious.
I think that's
the most precious thing, and you have to protect that.
And you know, a lot of our listeners are readers and writers themselves, and I think it's very powerful, you know, to hear from you, who you just became a full-time author, and that happens, and you have your own process, and it got you there. And also it can be fun along the way, as long as you hold on to some of these.
It 100% can. And look, you have to then be very hard on yourself in the later stages when you give it to your editor and your editor says, okay, well, this could be a published book, but it needs X, Y, and Z changing. And that's when the real hard work begins. And you have to go through that process. But that's a different process to the process of writing the thing, because no one else can do that but you. You have your own unique voice and your own unique perspective on the world and things to say. And you need to protect that like a little candle of, you know, creativity. And only you can keep it going and bring that work, whatever it is, to fruition. Having it published is a totally different thing, because it might then need, you know, a million changes, and that's fine. And sometimes that's hard to navigate, and it's emotionally hard work and all the rest of it. But I don't know, I guess I'm pretty realistic and relaxed about that, because I've been a journalist and I know that sometimes everything gets hacked in half, and, you know, that's just what happens.
You just have to roll with it.
It's fine. But then that's different. And then your book becomes something more collaborative, which is, and it's the fruit of a number of people's efforts. And editors are amazing people, and they save you from making, you know, stupid mistakes, and including boring chapters that no one cares about, that don't take the plot on, and all of that. And that needs to happen. All that process needs to happen. But I'm kind of talking about actually getting to a finished manuscript is really hard. It's really hard. And you're the only one that can do it. No one can help you in a way. So, and so you have to, and you're the only thing that's going to keep you going is if you keep hold of the joy. In it.
Oh, I think that's such powerful advice. And, you know, I think you can tell that you and your team, that the product turned out really great, and it's been on a number of must read lists for 2023. I mean, starred reviews on Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, you search your name right now and you can see all of the accolades. So first of all, congratulations. It's what a great project that you've turned out.
Oh, and thank you. I'm just so thrilled people like it. It's lovely. And I can't wait for more readers to discover it this week. It's being published, so it's super exciting.
Yes, everybody, please go read this book. It's just amazing. It's such a well-written, thrilling, mysterious, like, relatable, all of these things that you wouldn't think go together, but they just somehow do. But it's so good. But thank you so much for coming on today, Catherine, to this evening, spending your late hours with me today.
Not at all. It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, folks, as we wrap up another episode, we just want to say thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We also hope you'll join our community. To do that, feel free to poke around our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. The best way to stay in touch is to sign up for our twice monthly newsletter, and you can do that via the contact page on the website. We won't spam you. That takes way too much time. We're not going to do that. You can also use our website to read our community blog and show notes, submit an elevator pitch to be played on the show, submit a blog post, give us feedback, submit to be on the show, become a Patreon supporter, and to see what's coming up on the show next, order our podcast books, or listen to previous episodes. So many things, and the best part, it's all free. Until the next episode, this is Hannah LaRue, and on behalf of Sarah Archer and Landis Wade, read on, write on, and rock on.